Welcome to Purdue Crop Chat, a regular podcast from Hoosier Ag Today and the Purdue University Extension Service, featuring Purdue Extension soybean specialist Dr. Sean Castile and Extension corn specialist Dr. Dan Quinn. On this episode, Sean and Dan welcome Dr. Bill Johnson, professor of weed science at Purdue, and new Extension weed scientist Dr. Tommy Butts, who discuss weed strategies to kick off the season.
I think if we're in the pattern that we're in now, where our daytime air temps are primarily highs in the 50s, lows in the 30s, I think we're still okay to spray under those conditions, but expect the herbicides to work more slowly.
This podcast is made possible by the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and Indiana Soybean Alliance. Your Indiana corn and soybean checkoff investments yesterday are paying off today. New research, new uses, demand creation, bringing dollars back to the farm. Check it out at yourcheckoff.org. Now your host for Purdue Crop Chat, Hoosier Ag Today's Eric Pfeiffer.
We're back here at the Purdue Corn and Soybean Innovation Center in West Lafayette, and we're here to talk planting progress, of which there's been very little. Been awfully darn wet. Everywhere, it's just been wet. Eric Pfeiffer here, the stars of the show, over here to my left, Dr. Dan Quinn. Dan Corn Quinn. You know, I was speaking with someone recently, and I mentioned your name, and they said,
"Medicine woman, boy."
No. They didn't say doctor. They didn't say Dr. Quinn, medicine man, or okay. Dr. Quinn, corn man. They were like, "You didn't use his middle name." I said, "Oh, Dan Corn Quinn. That's what it is." So, hello, Dan.
I've been called worse. Hello, Eric.
This morning, I think he's been called worse. And soybean Sean Castile over there. How you
Howdy.
Doing, Sean?
Howdy, Eric.
We also have a couple of other guests here. You guys invite people, and I say, yeah, sure, why not? I mean, I'm just a guy here talking into a microphone. I can set up as many microphones as you need, except I am one short. Sorry, Bill. Bill Johnson is here. And Bill has been with us before. We've done this, I think, annually now for the past several years. Bill, we got weeds to talk about, so you're the guy, right?
Yeah, the revolution of the earth depends on controlling weeds.
So okay.
Just establish that right up front here.
All weeds must die.
And we have someone new to the podcast, someone new to Purdue. He was just telling me he's like brand spanking new. He's been here 2 weeks. You guys haven't even like shown him the hot spots around town yet at this point, right? Like,
no, we haven't, but we expect him to be delivering things to us. And he's done that already, so he's hit the mark there.
He has already arrived with donuts this morning. It took Dan like a year and a half to 2 years to figure that out, that the weight of my heart is through my stomach. But Tommy Butts has figured it out already. Hello, Tommy.
Hi, thanks for having me. I had some good advice from some grad students that warned me about the podcast, I guess, is a good way to put it.
So, and you still showed up.
That's right. So I made sure to bring some, and I'm glad to be here to talk about the most important in all of agriculture is just weeds.
Weeds.
You know, above everything. So yeah, glad
absolutely.
To be here.
They impact everything, you know. Tommy, first, before we get going here, introduce yourself a little bit. From what I understand, you're coming to us, do weeds really impact cheese up there in Wisconsin? I mean, that's where you're coming from, right?
Well, so that's where I originated from. I'm actually coming indirectly from Arkansas, so
okay.
I've kind of been all around. So I'm originally a Wisconsinite from southern Wisconsin, grew up on dairy farms, so you're welcome for cheese and
Amen.
Milk, and of course, beer. I mean, you know, that's a big Wisconsin thing as well, so you're welcome there. But I did my bachelor's degree at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, did a master's degree in weed science at Madison, went out to Nebraska to do a PhD, all in weed science areas. We actually like to say that I am a academic grandson to Bill over here, because both of my advisors were students under Bill at one time.
Wow.
So,
and I'm sure that doesn't make Bill feel
yeah.
old.
I was going to say, you just called Bill what here?
That's why I said grandson, because, you know, it's just indirect.
I heard him say great-grandson.
Yeah. I think he's just got his two-week notice is what I just heard.
But so some connections there already to Purdue. And then the last 5.5 years or so, I've been a faculty member down at the University of Arkansas, working in primarily soybeans and rice. So a little bit of diverse crops there. But we got to dabble in all kinds of stuff there, corn, wheat, peanuts, cotton a little bit. So a little bit of everything down there. And I've had a heavy extension appointment down there as well. So I'm used to the extension world as well and working with farmers and consultants and everybody like that. So I'm happy to be here now, working in weed science here. here. I'll be really technology focused for my role up here as well. So a lot of the different drones and See and Spray and various other technologies that are in the pipeline as well.
Very good. Well, we're happy to have you, and you're welcome back anytime as long as that pink box over there makes a return. So, guys, let's start off today's show. Obviously, we're going to get to the weeds, and I want to touch on some of the technology things that Tommy just talked about. But planting progress has been slow is an understatement. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, when I chat with folks, we're not behind by any means here, but mm-hmm. I know that folks would have liked to have gotten started by now, mm-hmm. especially, I think, you know, we've talked before with these soybeans, Sean, and it's just been a rough go of it. You know, people talk about, you know, watching paint dry. I think it might be worse watching fields dry because you're just sitting there like ready to go and mm-hmm. yep. you can't do anything.
Yeah, especially when you have the top of that soil that looks, oh, it looks all right. But then you actually start to dig down and you're making mud balls and they are not breaking up at all. Bill, I remember one of my first years, the farm manager here at the agronomy farm, Jim Beatty, would go out and we'd check out fields and everything else. And I said, oh, we need to get going. We need to get planting. And he would dig up, and maybe, I don't know if he did this to you or not, but he'd dig it up, and then he'd make a mud ball, and what would he do with it? He'd throw it right at your boot, and he said, did it break, yep. son? It's like, no, it didn't. It's like, well, I ain't getting in this field yet either. and those are the situations that we've had. So far, we've just been drying out on top, but not enough. You go back to March, gorgeous weather. We talked about that the last mm-hmm. podcast.
I mean, gorgeous weather in February.
Yeah,
I mean,
my goodness. No doubt. So I would love to flip the switch and have the months change out that we'd have that weather here in April. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're just in a waiting game. So we've got a lot of fertility out. We got a lot of tillage done, but now it's waiting to dry.
And USDA, in their report on Monday, their crop progress report, they say, you know, we haven't even registered with soybeans. We know there's some out there.
Yeah, there's definitely some. There's guys that had some out there in that March and even February. for the fun of it. But you got to look at insurance states and everything else. So, yeah, we're less than 1% in the state.
Yeah. But corn is registering here, 1%, whopping 1%. but again, it's just too stinking wet to really do anything, field work, planting, any of it.
Yeah, it's just a lot of farmers just sitting. I working with quite a few farmers this year on some on-farm trials. Was sending them prescriptions this week, and I think all of them had the same sentiment, right? It's just, we're just not, you know, everything's ready, right? The planter's hooked up, everything's dialed in, everything's shined up, everything's ready to go. It's just, they're just kind of waiting. We've had some nice weather here the last couple of weeks, but now, you know, as we move into this week and next week, it's going to dip down a little bit in the temperatures yet. I would say, you know, we are wet, but I would also say we kind of needed it. We were pretty dry coming into the last few weeks. So I think this moisture, you know, in hindsight has been a pretty good thing. Talking to colleagues out in Iowa, you know, I know Iowa has been going pretty strong. I saw Missouri's at like 26% planted already. So they're like way ahead of the game in the state of Missouri. And then I saw some planters going in Illinois. So they just haven't had the moisture in those states. They're still a little bit dry, but they've started to go. But yeah, Indiana, we're just kind of sitting and waiting. Still have time, right? Even, you know, we always talk about corn. We're going to see more and more folks just are looking to put those beans in first, and they're going to wait until the soil temperature is a little bit better, moisture is a little bit better to put some of that corn in the ground.
And I think this is the annual PSA here of, you know, your sins today can impact you for years, right? It's not just a one-time thing. Like, if you get out there and try pushing this thing too early, you're going to regret it, not mm-hmm. just this year, but next year, the year after.
Yeah, I mean, if you enjoy replanting, that's great, you know, or if you enjoy watching, you know, uneven stands or, but yeah, I mean, a big portion of the field calls that I'll take in the spring and going out to these farms, a lot of it, you know, factors back to, you know, planting conditions and what the root development is. And, you know, if you plant too wet, I still remember this last year, I did a field call with a farmer. He's like, you know, I got poor emergence, I got uneven stands, my crop just looks bad. Went out into his field, took the shovel, dug up one plant and held it out for him. And he just looked at me and goes, I should have waited a week, shouldn't I? And I said, yep. You know, so it's just like, it may seem okay, but you know, if you do plant where it's wet and you get some of those, you know, that sidewall compaction occurring and some of those issues occurring, it's just, especially for corn, it just, that corn crop will just struggle the rest of the year. Root development's poor. You end up getting nutrient deficiencies later on. You could have lodging issues down the line. It's just something that, again, like we said, going to haunt you the rest of the year.
Lessons learned.
No, that corn crop is just wimpy is what you're saying. It can't handle that? Is that what you just told me? It needs to have that perfect condition? Is that what you're saying?
Beautiful. You know, when you're thinking about, you know, you got your Hawaiian shirt on, you know, you're feeling good, you know, weather's nice, things are perfect, and then we can plant corn. When it's
kind of in flip-flops, I don't want to see that.
Kind of marginal, kind of crappy, you're not feeling so good, then you put the soybeans in.
Because they're tough to handle, is what you're saying. I understand.
And I think what the farmer we had on a few podcasts ago was because anyone can plant soybeans.
Oh, thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah. So, Bill, as we talk about all of this, we'll turn this over to a weed conversation. We talked about this rain. While it's frustrating that it's happening right this moment, it is still welcome. But that dry, mild winter, fall, did that have an impact on what we're seeing now from a weed standpoint?
Yeah, good question. So winter weed growth certainly took off here about a month or so ago. So a lot of the questions coming into my office this time of year really revolve around questions related to burn down. If the burn down didn't work as expected on weeds or on cover crops, we're kind of asked to diagnose why. Typically, poor performance of burn down can be related back to weather conditions around the day of application. And really, specifically, when we have a lot of cool nighttime temperatures a couple days before and a couple days after application, we can see the performance of systemic herbicides like glyphosate be somewhat challenged. The other question that we'll commonly get this time of year that is related to weather has to do with activation of soil-applied herbicides. So typically in the eastern corn belt where we're at here, we're wet. We usually get a nice activating rainfall for our pre-emerge herbicides to get them into solution. And really the questions more revolve around, have we gotten too much rainfall and have gotten the residual herbicides diluted to the point where they're breaking and starting to release some of the grasses and broadleaf species. But those are kind of the primary issues that we deal with. The other thing that'll come along here in a couple of weeks, as some of this corn crop starts to emerge, if we get a hard pounding rain and we pound those leaf tips back into the soil surface, we'll have herbicides being taken up by these leaf tips that have gotten pounded into the soil surface, and we'll start to see some injury issues with herbicides in those situations too.
You're listening to Purdue Crop Chat, brought to you by your Indiana Corn and Soybean Checkoff organizations. Visit yourcheckoff.org.
I've been seeing, and you guys jump in anytime here, your questions are probably better than mine. I've been seeing, as I'm driving around, fields of purple, and I look at them and it's like, man, these look pretty. Are these some pretty cover crops out here? But those are weeds, right? Those are weeds. Tommy's like, I want to talk about the purple weeds.
Well, so I just need to chime in on this, and I'll let Bill take it from there. But so we had a neighbor's field that was covered up. It's henbit and purple dead nettle are the weeds that are out there. My daughter loves purple. And so she was impressed every day that we got to see this purple field out in front of us. Well, the other day it got sprayed, and I had to fill her in that daddy's job is a part of getting rid of that purple, and she hasn't been too impressed with daddy past week.
You're a monster.
Yes, so I just wanted to throw that in there, but I'll let Bill chat more about it from there.
You need to bring more than donuts to your daughter, so it sounds like.
But yeah, those things, they're pretty weeds.
Yes, they are, and they're very common in no-till fields. And we've had these purple flowered weeds, henbit and purple dead nettle, for decades in this area, and actually throughout the Corn Belt. I think that, you know, the key thing to remember about the winter annual weeds is if we don't get them controlled, they can go on and produce seed, and obviously, you know, produce a seed bank for future years. But they can also, in conditions where we have daytime air temps in the 60s and some wet soils, the soils will not dry out very rapidly either. They'll kind of form a mat, and they'll prevent water from evaporating. The other thing about henbit and purple dead nettle is they can also serve as an alternative host for soybean cyst nematode. And so when we have in what appears to be the pattern that we're in now, kind of a warm, extended spring, but a little on the wet side, if we're not able to get the henbit and purple dead nettle controlled, we can allow more reproduction of SCN on those weeds in the springtime as well, which can increase to higher populations of those weeds in the long run.
Yeah, no, that's something that's always been a concern when we look at the soybean cyst nematode levels that are continuing to increase in that. So when you've got those purple, beautiful fields, but we've got a pattern where we are wet and we can't get in the field, so what's your best recommendation? Do you go in and kill it down and then know that you have to do another pass later? And then now we're coming into a week that's got 55, 60-degree weather. Yeah, but 40-degree night. So what's the balance of, okay, when do I pull the trigger to take care of that so I don't have a nematode population that's increasing, but then also have an activity from the herbicide standpoint?
Yeah, so as we talked about earlier, we run into challenges when we have a lot of cool nighttime temperatures. Yep. in systemic herbicide activity. I think if we're in the pattern that we're in now, where our daytime air temps are getting up in the, well, now they're up in the 70s, for at least another day anyway, but then next week we're going to be primarily highs in the 50s, lows in the 30s. I think we're still okay to spray under those conditions, but expect the herbicides to work more slowly.
Okay.
It's when we get these nighttime air temps that are down in the 20s,
okay,
we typically need at least 2 or 3 days of nights that don't get into the 20s in order to get the weeds actively growing again.
And really, it was some of those, 60, 70-degree days in March and even back in February that really let this kind of run rampant, right?
Yes. Yeah, and I think getting back to maybe completing the answer to Sean's question, I think, in our geography, typically it stays cold enough in March that I don't worry about controlling winter annual weeds in March. But I think in a year like this one, particularly if we know that the long-term weather pattern is going to have the temperatures in the right range for soybean cyst nematode to reproduce on mm-hmm. those roots, it probably would have been advantageous to control those weeds back in March. So maybe what you do back in March is you put out the glyphosate 2,4-D or whatever your sure. burndown program is, and then you still save your residual for use as a pre-emerge treatment. So you're not putting the residual herbicide out there when you don't have the summer annuals coming up.
So if we weren't able to do that, which a lot of fields are like that, and we know that we're pushing soybean plantings earlier and earlier, even in these wet conditions, so I see that coming in the next week or two, are you going ahead and do a burn down only, or are you going ahead and bring the residual? Think about the amount of activity with that residual. Is it going to be long enough, or do we to wait on that for the beans to start cracking before we do a more of a residual? What's the plan there?
Well, so I think it depends on the residual herbicide that you're going to use. So once beans start to crack and emerge, that takes the group 5, the group 14s, and a couple other herbicides kind of out of the equation. You're basically left with the group 15s and the ALS inhibitors are kind of the main ones. So given the fact that we're in the middle of April, I would put my residual on with the burn down at this time of year.
So a question that we've talked about a lot on here, and I'll ask you because this space is getting larger and larger, but biologicals in this weed space, do we have people attacking this here too with this biological space, and have we found any that work?
From the standpoint of weed control, there are some examples of products that are real specific for a single weed. There are still handling issues with most of these biologicals in terms of just keeping the organism alive while you're shipping it and storing it. So as of right now, there's nothing that's going to make a market impact in the next year or two.
I know. I had to go there, Dan. I mean, it's just, we had to go there and we had to find out because people are still asked. They're still wanting to know. And weed control is one of the bigger ones here that they want to try to tackle.
Yeah, I mean, I know. It's amazing, the biologicals, right? And that's a topic we can keep bringing up time and time again.
I think he has kept bringing it up time and time
again.
Yeah,
and we probably will keep. So I did want to ask, both Bill and Tommy, as we get into planting, right, this is, I would say, a really, really important time for these pre-emergence and these residual herbicides in terms of, still a lot of farmers that deal with resistance issues, a lot of farmers that just, water hemp is always a challenge for them. What are, just kind of some of the high level or things you kind of recommend at this point in time, things to watch for, things, that you're doing and making sure you're doing as a farmer at this point in time, so that you don't run into the issues with some of these really troublesome weeds like a water hemp later in the season?
Yeah, I think the low-hanging fruit type of answer to that question is go after your worst weed problems with at least 2 sites of action, preferably 3. The other thing to keep in mind is that our worst herbicide-resistant weeds are resistant to post-emerge herbicides. typically not pre-emerge herbicides. So your residual herbicide program really is the backbone in both corn and beans. There's a lot of broad spectrum pre-emerge herbicides that can be used out there that typically consist of two, three, sometimes even four active ingredients. So I think picking the right one for your field and then understanding the fact that most of these premixes are premixes of reduced rates of single active ingredients. And so you can bolster these premixes by adding some straight goods products to some specific premixes in order to broaden the spectrum of weeds that they control. So again, picking the right product, picking the right rate, and then really kind of this understanding that we want to take the pressure off the post-emerge herbicide is what's going to be the best solution in the short term.
You talk about picking the right product, picking the right rate. That's where some of your research comes in, right? And reviewing some of that. Talk about some of the research that you've been doing and maybe some of the success stories you've seen there that you've been able to translate and farmers have been able to translate into real-world results out there.
Oh, gosh, good question. I could go on for hours there.
We've got hours. I've nowhere to go. Go ahead.
No, I think, some of the things that we're particularly fond of and that get good traction with our farmer audience are just really spelling out what's in these premixes, how much active ingredient is some of the single component products that you get in the active ingredients, and what is the minimum rate needed in order to, say, make something like Trivence work better on water hemp. I mean, those are some simple things. The other thing that we've done, there's a tremendous amount of interest in cover crops and how residual herbicides work in cover cropping systems. I think one of the great things about being in the eastern corn belt and the fact that we get plenty of rain is that our residual herbicides really do play well with cover crops. We typically get enough rain to get it washed off the cover crop residue down into the soil, and we can certainly see some benefits from having those two things out there together, the residual herbicide and the cover crop on a couple of specific weed species, particularly things like mare's tail, annual grasses. We see some suppression of ragweed if we can get the biomass high enough. So I think those things have been pretty important components. The other thing that we're looking at now, and I'll let Tommy talk a little bit about this too, is right now we're doing a lot of kind of preliminary investigations with new technology with regard to weed control. And there's some promise out there that there's going to be some herbicide savings for the farmer. But again, these things are still kind of preliminary. And I don't know, Tommy, if you want to discuss some of the things that you think are a little bit more promising in that aspect, I'll give the microphone to you.
Well, what we're going to do, see, Bill doesn't understand this whole radio thing. That was a tease. That was a segue right there. He nailed it. And then he just let it go. He was about to hand the microphone over. You said the words herbicide savings for farmers, and it's like, oh, now we have to take a break and talk about the herbicide savings right after this.
Biodiesel is bringing value back to the farm, accelerating the demand for Indiana soybeans, increasing market value, and reducing greenhouse gases. The Indiana Soybean Alliance puts checkoff dollars to work, researching and promoting biodiesel in Indiana, growing production, creating nearly 3,200 jobs across Indiana, and increasing soybean ROI $36 per acre. The future of fuel is biodiesel. Learn more about biofuels at yourcheckoff.org.
All right, we're back now on the Purdue Crop Chat. Tommy does have the microphone now, and you've been waiting a whole 35 seconds or so now. Tommy, give it to us. Herbicide savings, go.
Well, and as usual, as a weed scientist, I get to be the depressing voice, probably. No, just kidding. Like Bill mentioned there, a lot of these new technologies that we're looking at are still bare bones foundation that we're trying to explore them. So I don't think there's anything right now I could say, boom, go out, here's your herbicide savings, you got it right now on your doorstep. Now, there's a lot of these things that look very promising, and I think, we give it another couple more years and we get a lot of the things fleshed out. There's some really good potential, things like the See and Spray from John Deere with the targeted sprays. There's several other companies looking at this too. There's several robotics companies looking at trying to, again, eliminate some of these post-emergence type herbicide applications. Again, with all the resistance we have in water hemp, giant ragweed, horseweed, mare's tail for those people out there that want to call it that. So there's a lot of options on the post side that we're losing. If we can get some of these technologies to target things more precisely, it can help a lot there. But I really do want to emphasize the point, most of these technologies that we're looking at do not get us away from residual herbicides. Residual herbicides are still going to be key for us moving forward to try and reduce the likelihood of herbicide resistance. It limits the amount of weeds that are coming up out of the soil that we have to worry about later on, so it potentially saves us more on those post-emergence products. So still really have in your mind that residuals are going to be important long-term. We're going to need those. We're going to need to get them activated. We have to appropriately select them for our weed species in the fields and stuff like that. And then after that, that's where these technologies will really step in from there.
And still with like the pre-emergence, right, you're not even looking at like these technologies to site specific apply these, right? You need them brought, you know, across the entire field, or is there aspects of these technologies with the pre-emergence?
So that's a great question. There is some research currently ongoing looking at maybe trying to, you know, like variable rate a pre-emergence application. If you've got soil types that vary across the field, or potentially if you have really solid field history and you know you have major weed hotspots in the field, can we potentially start treating those hotspots a little bit heavier, you know, maybe with three modes of action and then the rest of the field gets two or something, you know, okay. Like, can we start doing that? So there is some research going on in that area, but I'll say that's still, again, preliminary too, and it's not going to completely eliminate a residual from the entire field. Again, mm-hmm. You might save here or there, you can do some more targeted things, but across your field, you're still going to need the residuals on the whole, in my book, mm-hmm. Unless you've got...
Yeah, the only other thing I would add to that is, so far what we've learned in some preliminary work that most soil-applied residual herbicides rates are based on soil type. So the heavier soils, higher clay, higher organic matter content typically get higher rates. What we have found in some preliminary work is the weed seed bank isn't necessarily higher in the area where you apply the higher rates. And so I think one of the things moving forward that's going to be interesting resolution to have is understanding where the areas in the field are that have heavier weed seed banks that would benefit from those higher rates, because we're finding that the heavier soils don't necessarily benefit from them. So that's been one kind of preliminary finding so far.
So with the same topic, so I went to organic matter as well. I mean, there's plenty of fields that are going to have, we've got mucks, we've got sands in the same bloody field. And so you go from a 0.5% organic matter to over 6-10%, depending on if you really run mucks. So, that application rate with a pre is a lot of the organic matter. So from what you guys are talking about, do you think that this potential is organic matter, or it's, you know, we do that because some of the tie-ups, some of the chemistry, or is it more the weed population? I guess I'm still trying to figure out which way you think the market's going on that.
Well, so the way the market has gone to date has been based on chemistry. So basically your heavier soils with more clay content, yep, more organic matter, have higher CECs, and yep, so they're going to bind more herbicide, yep. less is going to be available in soil solution. I think if there's one place that technology can really benefit us is figuring out where the heavy weed seed banks are to adjust these herbicide rates. And that may be something, it may take us 5 to 10 years to get there if there's enough emphasis on that.
Well, and that was my question for Tommy here is, you know, you start off by saying, yeah, well, you know, we take a couple of years, flush some of these things out, build us, you know, throw out, you know, 5 to 10 years on this part of it. How far away are we on some of these things? Let's go in on the See and Spray stuff. How long before, you know, these things are actually identifying weeds and they're not actually spraying and killing the soybeans that are sitting there?
So some of this is already commercially available. So the See and Spray, for example, is actually commercially available. Now it's relatively limited. I can't remember how many they had this year. I think last year they had about 50, you know, that they released nationwide. They may be upping it a little bit more this year, that kind of thing. So it's commercially available, but it's not widespread. A lot of the robotics companies I've talked to, they're still in a lot of the testing phases, and a lot of them are focused not on major row crop agriculture right now. They're focused in the vegetable markets in California or the tree markets, orchards, things like that. So they're working their way there, but they're not focused on the big ag type area yet. Again, a couple years, there'll be some major highlights, but it's going to take a little bit yet.
So what I just heard there was, if you want it, it's going to be expensive right now, right? Is that what, am I hearing that right?
That's probably an understatement. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So can you use the same technology so that we just got done talking about the doing site specific on the pre side, but the weed bank is kind of the route that Bill's going, so what about the drones and imagery that we already do now year in and year out for crop scouting, for crop stress? Boy, we look for weeds out there probably too. So has there been any of that linkage to say, okay, I've got the population last year or 2 years ago based on this imagery. Can I use that, or is that just the pipe dream right now to kind of bring in what Bill's talking
you're,
about?
You're just looking for more uses for these drone images, aren't you? I mean,
well, I'm trying to give job security to Tommy.
I was gonna say, you have like a million things that can be done. The farmer's still just trying to get out there, see if they could take some pictures in many cases.
Well, I agree, right? with that.
We still have a little ways to go, but the question still stands.
Well, you said herbicide saving, so I'm trying to get money back to the farmer here.
There you go.
And Tommy said no. So is what he clearly said. There's no herbicide saving, so I'm trying to help him out.
Not yet. We're getting there. We're hoping. But weed science always seems to be job security. I don't know about that one, but I think we're around for
no
good.
No comment at this point.
Yeah. No, so there's a whole gamut of things that can be done from the drone perspective right now too, and there is some ongoing research. There still needs to be a whole lot more done, but you know, a couple examples of stuff that I know is going on in the background is currently there's a few projects out there that are using, you basically pre-fly a field and you can map out kind of where the weeds are at and ship out a shape file.
Sure.
And then basically do a prescription post-emergence application mm-hmm. that way. So there's already some work going in on that front. I know there's some other work going in at trying to identify some herbicide injury potential or drift potential with drones to help out on that aspect even more than just killing the weeds. And I think there's a wide open door, and this is kind of an area I want to explore a little bit more moving forward too, is trying to use some of these different sensors, whether it's multi-spec, hyper-spec, thermal, whatever else. Maybe there's some kind of X-ray sensor to get at what's in the soil, seed banks, or try and detect emergence that much sooner, that we can target these things a lot sooner and be more timely, I guess would be the way to put it. So there's a whole gamut of areas that I think we can start using these drones on that front. But again, it's still, we're on the very front end of a lot of
sure.
it. Yeah, and I think the other thing I want to mention just on the drone front too is it's going to be very interesting moving forward with the politics at play on the drone front. Mm-hmm. So with DJI and the potential federal ban that's yeah. going through, and how that's going to play into research and use across the country, you know, a lot of these other different drones that aren't on the DoD blue list and things like that, it's kind of an interesting area because you just don't know where we're going to be at as far as what the technology looks like within the next couple of years.
So your job is to be on the bleeding edge, unfortunately, is what it is, right?
That's right. And, you know, that's always tough. We were talking about trying to purchase equipment and everything else, and that always gets difficult, especially with this stuff that's changing yep. almost by the minute. And yep. so it gets difficult to be on that front. But at least if we can stay on top of knowing what's happening and then kind of making some comparisons, we can at least yeah. be there.
Instead of a drone, could you just get a big balloon and have it? No, we won't go there. I'll stay away from it. Go ahead, Dan.
I was going to say, what about, you know, you bring up drones. What about spray drones, right? That's a big topic out there, you know, in terms of herbicide, you know, some of the fungicide applications like that. You know, what have you done or what are you, you know, hoping to look at? And in terms of spray drones, where do you see them being beneficial? What are some of the challenges with them? Maybe touch on that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. And that's a great question, too. This is another 3-hour conversation here alone as well. But so there is Brian Young currently has graduate student hunter working on some spray drone things here at Purdue. When I was at Arkansas last year, we actually did a couple different spray drone studies as well, trying to just get some basic things figured out. The overall message that I would tell y'all just initially with spray drones is that they are complicated and there is no one size fits all extension recommendation that we can give, which is really frustrating. Because when you talk about, you know, a ground sprayer or even manned aerial applications from planes, we can pretty much make some general assumptions and give some pretty basic recommendations mm-hmm. across the board. What I've learned with the spray drones is everyone is unique, every setup is going to be different, every nozzle, rotor speed, rotor size, everything changes just exactly how they're going to work. So that gets real challenging. From just some basic perspectives that I've seen with them, I've been pleasantly surprised at how well they can work with some lower spray volumes. So last year we did a few studies in Arkansas looking at burn downs. And we used a low rate of a contact herbicide gramoxone because I wanted to break the system, right? That was my goal, was to break the system and see where it failed. And we had 2 GPA out of a drone, 5 GPA out of a drone, and then 10 GPA out of a ground rig as our standard comparison. Mm-hmm. The 5 GPA compared to the 10 GPA, the 5 GPA out of the drone compared to 10 GPA out of the ground rig, I saw zero differences in coverage, weed control, nothing. Looked exactly the same. The 2 GPA out of the spray drone lagged behind on coverage and lagged behind as far as the time it took to kill the weeds. It was delayed. Like at 7 days after, you could just tell them that it wasn't as brown. It was slowing a little bit. But 4 weeks after, everything was identical. So I would say there is some chances that some of these low spray volumes are still feasible to kill some weeds too. But it's as far as managing risk, that's the breaking point. So I'd rather see a little higher GPA where we're flying the drones a little bit slower. We're hopefully cutting down the swath widths a little bit. All of that will help make those things a lot more successful. But it seems like they can be very successful.
And that comparison was with a contact, right? That wasn't with the systemic. So do you have any work within the systemic to say, okay, yeah, I didn't get quite as much coverage, but I know it can get into that plant.
So I haven't done it specifically with the systemic yet. Just as comparisons for other things, I would expect that because we really didn't see that big of a difference on the contact front, with a systemic, it's going to be even better, yep. Right? Because we generally say you need less coverage or it's less important with a systemic herbicide. So I really would expect it to be, and something like Roundup actually really likes low spray volumes to begin with. There's been several studies that show 3 GPA with Roundup is better than anything else. Mm. And so the spray drone may be ideal for something like that. So there's a lot more potential than I was ever expecting, honestly. I think there's just a lot of kinks that need to be worked out, particularly with making sure we have these swaths set up appropriately and we're setting up our overlapping passes. Otherwise, we're going to streak some fields really, really bad. So
what kind of swaths are you really talking about then? That's realistic.
That's a great question, and it's highly variable on the drones again.
Now, he's already got this "it depends" answer down. You hear this?
Yeah,
they teach that in Arkansas just as much as Purdue.
Don't we have to go to politician school to be an extension? Okay. So, just a couple main examples. I know with the DJI, T30 and T40s are very popular out there. The T30 is one that we kind of plug our own nozzles on, like the typical ground rig nozzles. The T40 uses the rotary atomizer type nozzles. The T30, it's generally, when they're sold, it's generally stated they can have about a 25-foot swath width. Most of the stuff I've seen, you need to almost cut that down to about 15 to 18 to be really good. The T40, it's bigger. You can get a bigger swath width. Again, the same premise happens, though, when they're sold. They're told you can do about a 35-foot swath width, but most guys I've talked to are being much more successful at about a 24-foot swath width. So if it was my recommendation, T30, you're talking about a 15-foot swath. With a T40, you're talking about a 24, 25-foot swath, something like that.
As we look ahead, you know, we heard your couple years here, 5 to 10. How different does farming look 10 years from now, based on some of the things that you're working on now? Is it going to be, you know, Sean sitting on the tailgate of his truck and he's just looking at his phone and all the robots are doing the work for him? And I'm not talking about his grad student. I'm talking about actual robots, because we all know that's the case now.
I'm talking about then.
I just look at how much it's changed in 10 years already, from the last 10 years. I mean, it's amazing from just when I was in grad school to now how much stuff has changed and how much more technology has advanced. So I can't imagine what it's going to look like 10 years from now. The advancements in artificial intelligence and in machine learning, in these different imaging cameras. I mean, you know, a hyperspectral camera used to be $40,000-$50,000 easy, and now you can get one for a couple grand almost to stick on a drone. Like, it's amazing how far we've come in just 10 years or so. So yeah, it's going to drastically change. Again, a couple examples. I know there's a lot of work going on with equipment manufacturers at autonomous tractors, so that you don't have to have a man on the tractor. There's some work on the drone side where there's actually a dock, and you just set the dock outside and schedule every week. It goes and flies and maps your fields, collects whatever data you want. Maybe it starts identifying the hotspots for weeds, comes back, uploads all the data, and goes straight to your computer. There's already that technology available now. That's still expensive and cutting edge too, but it's there. So in 5-10 years, it's going to be incredible.
So you talk about job security. What's Dan going to do when that happens? You can't just tell people to go walk their fields all the time. I mean... What else is there?
They've got to put a shovel on it, though. That's one thing that the agronomists have always said. You got to dig up the plant. So once it does that, then we are out of a job.
Yep. You know, maybe we'll be retired by then, so we'll have to worry about it.
No, you got a few more years.
Yeah, you got some time there.
One question, you know, just getting I just wanted to hit on this topic a little bit different than what we've been talking about. Just in terms of dicamba, right, with the soybeans and stuff, has there, you know, been some changes? You know what, you know,
that's if you didn't see this, there was a quick handoff to Bill Johnson.
Bill might have a bruise on his chest of how quickly Tommy threw that thing at him.
So I've learned from my Arkansas days to just quickly evade anything dicamba related. So, Bill, okay.
That's why you left Arkansas. Is that
he threw that thing. I think he was yelling. It depends.
So I just want to, you know, that date jumps up on people, and it's always a big topic every year. I just, you know, wanted to bring that up.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So for the state of Indiana. For the products that are labeled for use in soybeans, so Extendamax, Tavium, and the other one, Ingenia, we still have a June 12th cutoff date. What the state chemist's office now is going through is we're going through the process of changing the cutoff date for the products used in corn and pastures to a date that's later in the summer. There's a high probability that that will be approved, and that will free us up to use dicamba later in corn. And if we take a look at the drift data that has made its way to the state chemist's office, we still only have about 5% of the drift complaints that are coming from corn as the source field. And so the rationale here is to open up the dates in terms of being able to use dicamba later in corn, so we have some more tools for particularly things like giant ragweed and water hemp.
And right now, as I understand it, we folks have what until May 13th to buy this stuff, because after that, you know, the existing use is that where we're at?
Well, yeah, anything that was considered to be existing stocks can still be moved this year. We do know that Bayer has applied for approval to be able to sell these products in the future. We don't know the status of that for 2025 yet.
That's only the soybean ones, though.
Yeah, that's only the soybean products, right.
Okay. All right. Guys, any other questions for the weed guys here? Anything else? I think you guys might be off the hook. You guys might be off the hook.
All right.
Now, we appreciate you coming. Like I say, we do this once or twice a year and get to have Bill in. I was a little disappointed that today when he introduced himself, it was normally it's I am the weeds guy, not the weed guy. So
he does look a little mellow today.
but guys, as we move on here, Sean, we'll start with you because, again, soybeans timely planting is still rapidly approaching here. You know, we need to get that done here sooner rather than later. What are we thinking right now? We've got to still be patient, right?
Yep. Yeah. We don't want to slap it in the ground. There's no doubt about that. Either corn or soybeans, we don't want to have seed troughs that are going to be smeared and everything else. So, I mean, we do get a pretty good bump on a timely planted soybean crop, especially when we put it to that other, I call it the weed, the corn crop. But all that to be said, you still need to have field conditions that are fit. Get in there. They can withstand a little bit more, I'd say, than what the corn can. But all that to say is we want a stand established so we have a root system that can access water, nutrients later in the season. You think about any kind of root system that's compromised, and then we have 3 weeks, 4 weeks of cool weather. Guess what? Again, these pre-herbicides, the crop has to metabolize a lot of that too. And so if they're restricted in some way, they're going to be compromised. So let's make sure we set up the stage for these plants to have the best growth as possible, but also get the benefit of that timely planting.
And we're not behind at this point.
Oh, by no means.
But at what point are we behind? Let's put that date out there. At what point are people like... I want a specific date.
At 11:41 a.m. on the day of when it has a 4-inch rain coming the next day is the wrong time. Now, usually I say within the I states, if we're late April, early May, that's a good sweet spot. If we can certainly pull the trigger next week and weather and field conditions are fit, that's great. But boy, when we start getting beyond May 10th, May 15th, I think that's when we do have a pretty substantial yield loss of potential yield loss. And that's where I say, okay, we're starting to get on the later side. Doesn't mean that we can't still yield well. Last year, great example. April 18th, planted beans, ran 100 bushel beans, and then May 12th ran 95. So we still didn't get the top, but I mean, that's still within 5 bushel and pretty respectable on a planting date study.
You see what happened there? He gave me two dates. He gave.
See, this is the beauty of it. No, I said it depends without saying it depends. That's what you have to learn.
Yeah. No. He first says, you know, late April, early May, and I'm like, okay, there he goes again. He's like, May 10th, May 15th, and it's like, okay, now we've got two dates.
Well, we cover quite a bit of territory here, right?
Oh, okay. So, All right.
I'll leave it at that.
Go north to south, and you split it up how you want to at home. Dan, what do we think?
Yeah, I think, you know, very similar on the corn side. We're still got time, right? Patience is important. Corn's a little similar. You know, you look at previous research and documentation, right? You look at, you know, we're beginning May, you're losing 0.1% potential yield per day. As you get closer to late May, right, it jumps up to about 1% potential yield per day. You know, corn, I've seen outstanding corn yields that were planted June 1st and May 31st. Doesn't mean you need to shoot for those dates, right? But it's, I really pay attention to the soil temperatures, right? We always bring up this topic where with corn, I want it out of the ground quickly and I want it out of the ground uniformly, right? So if I plant and soil temperatures are 50, hovered around 50, and it sits in the ground for 2 weeks, where if I could have waited, you know, a week or two and soil temps are, say, 60, 65, and it gets out of the ground in, you know, 5-7 days, oftentimes that sets that crop up a little bit better. But still need to plant timely, right, and really watch those conditions. So if you're, you know, still getting in early May into mid-May, that's often when you want to shoot for with the planting date in corn. But just really paying attention to those conditions is so important this time of year. And then, you know, as you get out in the field, you know, I know you get excited and you get in a rush, right? It's still important to just, you know, check where that seed is at, check the depth of that seed, you know, the consistency of the seed, just making sure everything is set up and ready to go. So it's still important to, you know, we're slowly eliminating all the things that I need to get out of the tractor for. That's still something, you know, that you know, getting out of the tractor, you know, at least a couple times, checking the seed depth, checking the conditions as you pull into those fields.
That's just so your sciatic nerve doesn't act up in your old age, right? Yes. That you need to stretch a little bit more.
Yeah, stretch a little bit more, you know. And, you know, a couple pieces of advice I saw, you know, on some of the social media sphere, don't plant, you know, don't back up with the planter in the ground. I think that's, you know, another rule. And then another one is, you know, don't finish your lunch in the tractor by about 10 a.m. You got to make that last, you know, make sure you have enough snacks in the tractor cab.
Have
really,
the
really
snack
important.
Bag.
Yes.
Yeah. My grandma had the old Pringles can, but it was full of cookies. So that's what I always look forward to having in the cab, was the Pringles can that I knew was cookies. Yep.
You know, it's funny. I think Dan might have just done the same thing that my wife has started doing, where she says, you know, I read somewhere, you know darn well it was a TikTok video, Dan. You aren't reading anything. You're watching TikTok and Reels on Instagram and everything else. Acting like you're well-read. My goodness. Well, guys, I hope that, you know, it was nice for this one that it was pretty easy to schedule, because you guys, you know, can't do anything because it's been so darn wet. I'm hoping that we can still get something scheduled here in a couple of weeks, but maybe that it's a bit more difficult because, you know, you and every other farmer in Indiana has some work to get done. But we'll get back together here soon. Thanks, Bill, Tommy. Appreciate you guys joining us today. Guys, we'll chat with you again here in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Purdue Crop Chat, a regular series featuring Purdue Extension's Dr. Dan Quinn and Dr. Sean Castile, made possible by the Indiana Corn and Soybean Checkoffs, the Indiana Corn Marketing Council, and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. The Checkoffs are pleased to help bring you agronomy insights from Purdue Extension. Opinions on the podcast are those of the host and guests and not those of the sponsor. Purdue Crop Chat is a service of Purdue University Extension and Hoosier Ag Today. Timely, relevant, credible.